can't with Sard. This essay was to have served as a preface to Philosophy in the Bedroom. It was published in the journal Critique as a review of the edition of Sard's work for which it was intended. The 15-volume set, brought out in 1963 by Édition du Cercle du Livre Précieux. The notion that Sard's work anticipated Freud's, if nothing else, as a catalogue of the perversions, is a stupidity repeated in works of literary criticism, the blame for which goes, as usual, to the specialists. I, on the contrary, maintain that the Sardian bedroom is of the same stature as those places from which the schools of ancient philosophy borrowed their names. Academy, Lyceum, and Stoa. Here as there, one paves the way for science by rectifying one's ethical position. In this respect, Sard did indeed begin the groundwork that was to progress for 100 years in the depths of taste in order for Freud's path to be passable. Add to that another 60 years before one could say why. If Freud was able to enunciate his pleasure principle without even having to worry about indicating what distinguishes it from the function of pleasure in traditional ethics, without risking that it be understood by echoing a bias uncontested for 2,000 years as reminiscent of the attractive notion that a creature is preordained for its good and of the psychology inscribed in different myths of benevolence. We can only credit this to the insinuating rise in the 19th century of the theme of delight in evil. Sard represents here the first step of a subversion of which Kant, as a piquant, as this may seem in light of the coldness of the man himself, represents the turning point, something that has never been pointed out as such, to the best of my knowledge. Philosophy in the Bedroom came 8 years after the Critique of Practical Reason. If after showing that the former is consistent with the latter, I can demonstrate that the former completes the latter, I shall be able to claim that it yields the truth of the Critique. As a result, the postulates with which the Critique concludes, the alibi of immortality in the name of which it suppresses progress, holiness, and even love, everything satisfying that could come from the law, and its need for a will to which the object that the law concerns is intelligible, losing even the lifeless support of the function of utility to which Kant confined them, reduce the work to its subversive core. This explains the incredible exaltation that anyone not prepared by academic piety feels upon reading it, a reaction that will not be spoiled by my having explained it. One might say that the shift involved in the notion that it feels good to do evil, or, if you will, that the eternal feminine does not elevate us, was made on the basis of a philological remark, namely that the idea that had been accepted up until then, which is that it feels good to do good, is based on a homonym not found in German. Man fühlt sich wohl im Guten. This is how Kant introduces us to his Critique of Practical Reason. The pleasure principle is the law of feeling good, which is wohl in German, and might be rendered as well-being. In practice, this principle would submit the subject to the same phenomenal sequence that determines his objects. The objection that Kant raises against this, in accordance with his rigorous style, intrinsic. No phenomenon can lay claim to a constant relationship to pleasure. No law of feeling good can thus be enunciated that would define the subject who puts it into practice as will. The quest to feel good would thus be a dead end, were it not reborn in the form of Das Gut, the good that is the object of the moral law. Experience tells us that we make ourselves hear commandments inside of ourselves, the imperative nature of which is presented as categorical, in other words, unconditional. Note that this good is assumed to be the good only if it presents itself, as I just said, in spite of all objects that would place conditions upon it. That is, only if it opposes any and every uncertain good that these objects might bring one according to some theoretical equivalence, such that it impresses us as superior owing to its universal value. Thus, the weight of the good appears only by excluding everything the subject may suffer from due to his interest in an object, with a drive or feeling, what Kant designates for that reason as pathological. We would thus find anew here the sovereign good of the Greeks by induction from this effect. In Kant, as is his wont, did not specify once more that this good does not act as a counterweight, but rather, so to speak, as an anti-weight, that is, as subtracting weight from the pride the subject experiences as contentment in his pleasures, insofar as a good at this good renders these pleasures less respectable. This is both precisely what the text says and quite suggestive. Let us consider the paradox that it is at the very moment at which the subject is no longer as any object before him that he encounters a law that has no other phenomenon than something that is already signifying. The latter is obtained from a voice in conscience, which, articulating in the form of a maxim in conscience, proposes the order of a purely practical reason or will there. For this maxim to constitute a law, it is necessary and sufficient that, being put to the test of such a reason, the maxim may be considered universal as far as logic is concerned. This does not mean, let us recall what logic entails, that it forces itself on everyone, but rather that it is valid in every case, or, better stated, that it is not valid in any case, if it is not valid in every case. But this test, which must be based on pure, though practical, reason, can only be passed by maxims of the type that allows for analytic deduction. This type is illustrated by the faithfulness required in returning a deposit. We can get some shut eye after making a deposit, knowing that the depositary must remain blind to any condition that would oppose this faithfulness. In other words, there is no deposit without a depositary, worthy of his task. One can sense the need for a more synthetic foundation, even in such an obvious case. At the risk of some irreverence, let me in turn illustrate the flaw in it with a maxim of Father Ubu that I have modified slightly. Long live Poland, for if there were no Poland, there would be no Poles. Let no one, out of some slowness of wit or emotivity, doubt my attachment to a freedom without which the people mourn. But while the analytic explanation of it here is irrefutable, its indefectibility is tempered by the observation that the Poles have always been known for their remarkable resistance to the eclipses of Poland, and even to the lamentation that ensued. We encounter anew here what led Kant to express his regret that no intuition offers up a phenomenal object in the experience of the moral law. I agree that this object slips away throughout the critique, but it can be surmised in the trace left by the implacable sweet Kant provides to demonstrate its slipping away, from which the work derives an eroticism that is no doubt innocent but perceptible, the well-foundedness of which I shall show through the nature of the said object. This is why I will ask those of my readers who are still virgins with respect to the critique, never having read it, to stop reading my text here and to return to it after perusing Kant's. Let me see if it does indeed have the effect I say it does. In any case, I promise them the pleasure that is brought by the feat itself. The other readers will follow me now into philosophy in the bedroom, at least in the reading thereof. It proves to be a pamphlet, but a dramatic one, in which the stage lighting allows the dialogue and the action to be taken to the very limits of what is imaginable. The lights go dark for a moment to make room for a diatribe, a sort of pamphlet within the pamphlet entitled Yet Another Effort, Frenchmen, If You Would Become Republicans. What is enunciated in it is ordinarily understood, if not appreciated, as a mystification. One need not be alerted to the fact that a dream within a dream points to a closer relationship to the real to see an indication of the same kind in the text deriding of the historical situation. It is blatant, and one would do well to look twice at the text. The crux of the diatribe is, let us say, found in the maxim that proposes a rule for jouissance, which is odd in that it defers Kant's mode in being laid down as a universal rule. Let us enunciate the maxim. I have the right to enjoy your body, anyone can say to me, and I will exercise this right without any limit to the capriciousness of the exactions I may wish to satiate with your body. Such is the rule to which everyone's will would be submitted, assuming a society were to forcibly implement the rule. To any reasonable being, both the maxim and the consent assumed to be given in it are at best an instance of black humour. But aside from the fact that if the deductions and the critique prepared us for anything, it is for distinguishing the rational from the sort of reasonable that is no more than resorting in a confused fashion to the pathological, we now know that humour betrays the very function of the superego in comedy. A fact that, to bring this psychoanalytic agency to life by instantiating it and to wrest it from the renewed obscurantism of our contemporaries' use of it, can also spice up the Kantian test of the universal rule with the grain of salt it is missing. Are we not thus incited to take more seriously what is presented to us as not entirely serious? As you may well suspect, I will not ask if it is necessary or sufficient that a society sanction a right to jouissance by permitting everyone to lay claim to it, for its maxim to thus be legitimized by the imperative of moral law. No de facto legality can decide if this maxim can assume the rank of universal rule, since this rank may also possibly oppose to all de facto legalities. This is not a question that can be settled simply by imagining it, and the extension of the right that the maxim invokes to everyone is not what is at issue here. At best, one could demonstrate here the mere possibility of generalizability, which is not universalizability. The latter considers things as they are, grounded, and not as they happen to work out. I cannot pass up the opportunity to point out the exorbitant nature of the role people grant to the moment of reciprocity in structures, especially subjective ones, that are intrinsically incompatible with reciprocity. Reciprocity, a relation that is reversible since it is established along a simple line that unites two subjects who, due to their reciprocal position, consider this relation to be equivalent, is difficult to situate as the logical time of any sort of breakthrough on the subject's part in his relation to the signifier, and far less still as a step in any sort of development, whether or not it can be considered psychical, in which it is always so convenient to blame the child when providing veneers with a pedagogical intent. Be that as it may, we can already credit our maxim with serving as a paradigm for a statement that as such excludes reciprocity. Reciprocity and not my turn next time. Any judgment regarding the odious social order that would enthrone our maxim is thus of no import here, for the question is whether to grant or refuse to grant this maxim the characteristic of a rule acceptable as universal in a moral philosophy. Moral philosophy being recognized since Kant's time as involving the unconditional practice of reason. We must obviously acknowledge this characteristic in the maxim for the simple reason that its sole proclamation, its kerygma, has the virtue of instating both the radical rejection of the pathological, that is, of every preoccupation with goods, passion, or even compassion, in other words, the rejection by which Kant cleared the field of moral law, and the form of this law, which is also its only substance, insofar as the will becomes bound to the law only by eliminating from its practice every reason that is not based on the maxim itself. Of course, these two imperatives between which moral life can be stretched, even if it snaps our very life, are imposed on us, according to the Sartian paradox, as if upon the other and not upon ourselves. But this only differs from Kant's view at first blush, for the moral imperative latently does no less, since its commandment requisitions us as other, We perceive quite nakedly here what the aforementioned parody of the obvious universality of the depositary's duty was designed to introduce us to, namely, that the bipolarity upon which the moral law is founded is nothing but the split in the subject brought about by any other, by any and every intervention of the signifier, the split between the enunciating subject and the subject of the statement. The moral law has no other principle, yet it must be blatant, for otherwise it lends itself to the mystification we sense in the gag, "Long live Poland." And coming out of the other's mouth, Sade's maxim is more honest than Kant's appeal to the voice within, since it unmasks the split in the subject that is usually covered up. The enunciating subject stands here as clearly as in "Long Live Poland," where the only thing that sticks out is what its manifestation amusingly evokes. To confirm this view, one need but consider the doctrine with which Sade himself establishes the reign of his principle, the doctrine of human rights. He cannot use the notion that no man can be the property or in any way the prerogative of another man as a pretext for suspending everyone's right to enjoy him, each in his own way. The constraint he endures here is not so much one of violence as of principle. The problem for the person who makes it into a long sentence, into a sentence, not being so much to make another man consent to it as to pronounce it in his place. Thus the discourse of the right to jouissance clearly posits the other qua free, the other's freedom, as its enunciating subject in a way that does not differ from the two s, which is evoked out of the lethal depths of every imperative. But this discourse is no less determinant for the subject of the statement, giving rise to him with each addressing of its equivocal content, since jouissance, shamelessly avowed in its very purpose, becomes one pole in a couple, the other pole being in the hole that jouissance already drills in the other's locus in order to erect the cross of Sadean experience in it. Leaving off my discussion of its mainspring here, let me recall instead that pain, which projects its promise of ignominy here, merely intersects the express mention of it made by Kant among the connotations of moral experience. What pain is worth in Sadean experience will be seen better by approaching it via what might be disconcerting in the artifice the Stoics use with regard to it, scorn. Imagine a revival of Epictetus in Sadean experience. "You see, you broke it," he says, pointing to his leg. To reduce jouissance to the misery of an effect in which one's quest stumbles, doesn't this transform it into a disgust? This shows that jouissance is that by which Sadean experience is modified, for it only proposes to monopolize a will after having already traversed it in order to instate itself at the inmost core of the subject whom it provokes, beyond that by offending his sense of modesty. For modesty is an amboceptor with respect to the circumstances of being. Between the two, the others, the one's immodesty by itself violating the other's modesty, a connection that could justify were such justification necessary, what I said before regarding the subject's assertion in the other's place. Let us question this jouissance, which is precarious because it depends on an echo that it sets off in the other, only to abolish it little by attaching the intolerable to it. In the end, it doesn't seem to us to be thrilled only by itself, like another horrible freedom. Thus we will see appear the third term that, according to Kant, is lacking in moral experience, namely the object that Kant, in order to guarantee to it the will in the implementation of the law, is constrained to relegate to the unthinkability of the thing in itself. But is this not the very object we find in Sadean experience, which is no longer inaccessible and is instead revealed as the being in the world, the Dasein of the tormenting agent? Yet it retains the opacity of that which is transcendent, for this object is strangely separated from the subject. Let us observe that the herald of the maxim need be no more here than a point of broadcast. It could be a voice on the radio recalling the right promoted by the supplemental effort the French would have consented to make in response to Sade's appeal, the maxim having become an organic law of their regenerated republic. Such a voice-related phenomena, especially those found in psychosis, truly have this object-like appearance. And in its early days, psychoanalysis was not very far from relating the voice of conscience to psychosis. Here we see why Kant views this object as evading every determination of transcendental aesthetics, even though it does not fail to appear in a certain bulge in the phenomenal veil, being not without hearth or home, time, intuition, modality situated in the unreal or effect in reality. It is not simply that Kant's phenomenology is lacking here, but the voice, even if insane, forces upon us the idea of the subject, and that the object of the law must not suggest malignancy on the part of the real God. Christianity has assuredly taught men to pay little attention to God's jouissance, and this is how Kant makes palatable his voluntarism of law for law's sake, which is something that exaggerates, one might say, the ataraxia of the Stoics. One might be tempted to think that Kant feels pressured here by what he hears too close by, not from Sade, but from some nearby mystic in the sigh that muffles what he glimpses beyond, having seen that his God is faceless. Grimgrickheit, Sade says, supremely evil being. But humph, Schwarmeraine, black swarms. I chase you away in order to return to the function of presence in the Sardian fantasy. This fantasy has a structure that we will see again further on. In it, the object is but one of the terms in which the quest it figures can die out. When jouissance petrifies in the object, it becomes the black fetish, in which can be recognized the form that was verily and truly offered up at a certain time and place, and is still is in our own time, so that one can adore the God therein. This is what becomes of the executioner in sadism, when, in the most extreme case, his presence is reduced to being no more than the instrument. But the fact that the executioner's jouissance becomes fixated there does not spare his jouissance the humility of an act in which he cannot help but become a being of flesh and, to the very marrow, a slave to pleasure. This duplication neither reflects nor reciprocates. Why wouldn't it? Mutualize. The duplication that took place in the other owing to the subject's two alterities. Desire, which is the henchman of the subject's split, would no doubt be willing to call itself will to jouissance. But this appellation would not make desire any more worthy of the will it invokes in the other, in tempting that will to go right to the extreme of its division from its pathos. For when it does so, desire departs, beaten down, doomed to impotence. For desire disappears under the pleasure's sway, pleasure's law being such as to make it always fall short of its aim. The homeostasis of the living being always too quickly re-establishes at the lowest threshold of tension at which he scrapes by, the ever-early fall of the wing with which desire is able to sign the reproduction of its form, a wing which here must nevertheless rise to the function of representing the link between sex and death. Let us say, lay that wing to rest behind its illusionian veil. Let us lay that wing to rest behind its illusionian veil. Pleasure, arrival of the will in Kant's system that provides a stimulus, is thus in Sade's work no more than a flagging accomplice. At the moment of climax, it would simply be out of the picture if fantasy did not intervene to sustain it with the very discord to which it succumbs. Stated differently, fantasy provides the pleasure that is characteristic of desire. Let us recall that desire is not the subject, for it cannot be indicated anywhere in a signifier of any demand whatsoever, for it cannot be articulated in the signifier even though it is articulated there. Taking pleasure in fantasy is easy to grasp here. physiology shows that pain has a longer cycle than pleasure in every respect. Since a stimulation provokes pain at the point at which pleasure stops. However prolonged one assumes it to be, pain, like pleasure, nevertheless comes to an end when the subject passes out. Such is the vital datum that fantasy takes advantage of in order to fixate. In the sensory aspect of Sartian experience, the desire that appears in its agent. Fantasy is defined by the most general form it receives in an algebra I have constructed for this purpose, namely the formula Bard S lozenge A, in which the lozenge is to be read as desire 4, being read right to left in the same way, introducing an identity that is based on an absolute non-reciprocity. This relation is coextensive with the subject's formations. Be that as it may, this form turns out to be particularly easy to animate in the present case. Indeed, it relates the pleasure that has been replaced by an instrument, object A in the formula, here to the kind of sustained division of the subject that experience orders. This only occurs when its apparent agent freezes with the rigidity of an object, in view of having his division as a subject entirely reflected in the other. From the vantage point of the unconscious, a quadripartite structure can always be required in the construction of a subjective ordering. My didactic schemas take this into account. Let us modulate the Sartian fantasy with a new schema of this kind. Schema 1. What he has here is a lowercase d, which I assume is desire, an arrow to A, an arrow that travails up to a capital V, then an angle down to a bottom right-hand corner from the top left-hand corner of V, capital V, down to Bard subject S, and then north from bar subject S to capital S, and the lozenge is in between A and S. A being in the bottom left-hand corner, barred S being in the bottom right-hand corner. Sorry, the lozenge separates those two. The lower line accounts for the order of fantasy insofar as it props up the utopia of desire. That's desire going to lowercase a, object R, lozenge, and then Bard S, the subject Bard, subject of the signifier. The curvy line depicts the chain that allows for a calculus of the subject. It is oriented, and its orientation constitutes here an order in which the appearance of object A in the place of the cause is explained by the universality of its relationship to the category of causality. Forcing its way into Kant's transcendental deduction, this universality would base a new critique of reason on the linchpin of impurity. Next, there is the capital V, which, occupying the place of honour here, seems to impose the will that dominates the whole business, but its shape also evokes the union of what it divides by holding it together with a vel, namely, by offering up to choice what will create the barred S of practical reason from capital S, the brute subject of pleasure, the pathological subject. Thus it is clearly Kant's will that is encountered in the place of this will that can only be said to be a will to jouissance if we explain that it is the subject reconstituted through the alienation at the cost of being nothing but the instrument of jouissance. Thus Kant, being interrogated with Sartre, that is, Sartre serving here, in our thinking as in his sadism as an instrument, avows what is obvious in the question, what does he want, which henceforth arises for everyone. Let us now make use of this graph in its succinct form to find our way around in the forest of the fantasy that Sartre develops according to a systematic plan in his work. We will see that there is a statics of the fantasy, whereby the point of aphanesis, assuming to lie in barred S, must in one's imagination be indefinitely pushed back. This explains the hardly believable survival that Sade grants to the victims of the abuse and the tribulations he inflicts in his fable. The moment of their death seems to be motivated there merely by the need to replace them in a combinatory which alone requires their multiplicity. Whether unique, Justine, or multiple, the victim is characterized by the monotony of the subject's relation to the signifier, in which, if we rely on our graph, she consists. The troop of tormentors, see Juliet, being object A in the fantasy and situating themselves in the real, can have more variety. The requirement that the victim's faces always be of incomparable and, moreover, unalterable, as I just said, beauty is another matter, which we cannot account for with a few banal and quickly fabricated postulates about sex appeal. Rather, we should see here the grimace of what I have shown regarding the function of beauty in tragedy, the ultimate barrier that forbids access to a fundamental horror. Consider Sophocles' Antigone, and the moment when the words something, something, something ring out. I can't read that because it's in Greek. This excursus would be no more value here did it not introduce what one might call the discordance between the two deaths introduced by the existence of the condemnation. The between two deaths of the shy of is essential to show us that it is no other than the one by which the beyond is sustained. This can be clearly seen in the paradox constituted in Sade's work by his position regarding hell. The idea of hell, refuted 100 times by him and cursed as religious tyranny's way of constraining people, curiously returns to explain the gestures of one of his heroes who is, nevertheless, among the most taken with libertine subversion in its reasonable form, the hideous Saint Fond. The practices whose final agony he imposes on his victims are based on his belief that he can render their torment eternal in the hereafter. He highlights the authenticity of this behavior by concealing it from his accomplices, and the authenticity of this credence by the difficulty he has explaining himself. Thus we hear him, a few pages later, try to make his behavior and credence sound plausible in his discourse with the myth of an attraction tending to gather together the particles of evil. This incoherence in Sade's work, overlooked by sadists, they too are a bit hagiographic, could be explained by noting in his writings the formerly expressed term, the second death, the assurance he expects from it against the awful routine of nature, which crime, as he tells us elsewhere, serves to disrupt, would require that it go to an extreme in which the vanishing of the subject is redoubled. He symbolizes this in his wish that the very decomposed elements of our body be destroyed so that they can never again be assembled. The fact that Freud nevertheless recognizes the dynamism of this wish in certain of his clinical cases, and that he very clearly, perhaps too clearly, reduces its function to something analogous to the pleasure principle by relating it to a death drive, demand for death, this will not be accepted by those who have been unable to learn from the technique they owe Freud, or from his teachings, that language has effects that are not simply utilitarian or, at the very most, for purposes of display. Freud is only of use to them at conventions. In the eyes of such puppets, the millions of men for whom the pain of existence is the original reason for the practices of salvation that they base on their faith in Buddha, are undoubtedly underdeveloped, or rather, they think like Boulos, the director of La Revue des Deux Mondes, who told Renan straight out when he turned down his article on Buddhism, this according to Bonouf, at some point during the 1850s, that it is impossible that there are people that dumb. if they believe that they have better ears than other psychiatrists, have they somehow escaped hearing such pain in a pure state? Model the song of certain patients referred to as melancholic. Have they not heard one of those dreams by which the dreamer remains overwhelmed, having in the felt condition of an inexhaustible rebirth plumbed the depths of the pain of existence? Or, in order to put hell's torments back in their place, torments which could never be imagined beyond what men traditionally inflict in this world, shall we implore them to think of our everyday life as having to be eternal? We must hope for nothing, not even hopelessness, to combat such stupidity, which is in the end sociological. I am mentioning it here only so that people on the outside will not expect too much concerning sad from the circles of those who have a surer experience of forms of sadism, especially regarding a certain equivocal notion that has been gaining ground about the relation of reversion that supposedly unites sadism with a certain idea of masochism. It is difficult for those outside such circles to imagine the muddle these notions create. This notion creates. We would be better to learn from it the lesson contained in a fine little tale told about exploitation of one man by another, which is the definition of capitalism as we know. And socialism, then, it is the opposite. Unintended humour. This is the tone with which a certain circulation of psychoanalysis occurs. It fascinates people because it goes, moreover, unnoticed. But there are doctrinaires who strive for tidier appearances. One acts the part of a do-good existentialist, another, more soberly, that of a ready-made personalist. This results in the claim that the saddest denies the other's existence, which is precisely, one must admit, what has just come out in my analysis. To pursue my analysis, it is not the case, rather, that the saddest discharges the pain of existence into the other, but without seeing that he himself thereby turns into an eternal object, if Whitehead is willing to let us have this term back. But why wouldn't it belong to both of us? Isn't this redemption in an immortal soul the status of the Christian? Let us not proceed too quickly, so as not to go too far, either. Let us note, instead, that Sartre is not duped by his fantasy insofar as the rigour of his thinking is integrated into the logic of his life. Let me give my readers an assignment here. The fact that Sartre delegates a right to jouissance to everyone in his republic is not translated in my graph by any symmetrical reversal along an axis or around some central point, but only by a 90-degree rotation of the graph as follows. Schema 2. He's rotated the graph. Desire is pointing upwards towards the bard subject, which continues on its trajectory toward S, and the Z that entails heads upwards to the top right from bottom left, S bard, which has an arrow directing it from little a to capital V. V, the will to jouissance, leaves no further doubt as to its nature, because it appears in the moral force implacably exercised by the president of Montreuil, Sard's mother-in-law, on the subject. It can be seen that the subject's division does not have to be pinned together in a single body. Let us note that it is only the first consul who seals this division with its effect of administratively confirmed alienation. This division here pins together as S, the brute subject incarnating the heroism characteristic of the pathological in the form of faithfulness to Sard manifested by those who at first tolerated his excesses, his wife, his sister-in-law, and why not his manservant too, and others who have been effaced from his history. For Sartre, S. Bard, or Bard S., we finally see that as a subject, it is through his appearance that he makes his mark, things having come to their term. Incredibly, Sartre disappears without anything, even less for Shakespeare, of his image remaining to us after he gave orders in his will to have a thicket efface the very last trace on stone of a name that sealed his fate. two Greek words that I can't read, but they mean not to be born. Sard's curse is less holy than Oedipus's, and does not carry him toward the gods, but is immortalized in his work, whose unsinkable buoyancy Jules Janin backhandedly shows us, saluting it behind the books that hide it, if we are to believe him in every worthy library, like the writings of St. John Chrysostom, or Pascal's Pensées. But Sard's work is annoying, according to you. Yes, like thieves at a fair, your honour and member of the Académie Française. But his work always suffices to bother you, one of you by the other, both one and the other, and one in the other. A fantasy is, in effect, quite bothersome, since we do not know where to situate it due to the fact that it just sits there, complete in its nature, as a fantasy whose only reality is as discourse, and which expects nothing of your powers, asking you, rather, to square accounts with your own desires. The reader should now reverentially approach those exemplary figures who in the Sardian boudoir assemble and disassemble in a carnival act-like rite, change of positions. It is a ceremonial pause, a sacred scansion. Let us salute here the objects of the law, of which you will know nothing unless you know how to find your way around in the desires those objects cause. It is good to be charitable, but to whom? That is the question. A certain Monsieur Verdoux answered this question every day by putting women in an oven until he himself got the electric chair. He thought that his family wanted to live in greater comfort, more enlightened. The Buddha offered himself up to be devoured by those who did not know the way. Despite this eminent patronage, which might well be based solely on a misunderstanding, it is not clear that a tigress enjoys eating Buddha. Verdoux's abnegation stemmed from an error that deserves to be dealt with severely, since a little lesson from the critique, which does not cost much, would have helped him avoid it. No one doubts but that the practice of reason would have been more economical and more legal, even if his family would have had to go hungry now and then. But what's with all these metaphors, you will say, and why? The molecules that are monstrous insofar as they assemble here for an obscene jouissance awaken us to the existence of other more ordinary jouissances encountered in life, whose ambiguities I have just mentioned. They are suddenly more respectable than these latter, appearing purer in their valences. Desires, here are the only things that bind them, and they are exalted in making it clear that desire is the other's desire. If you have read my work up to this point, you know that, more accurately stated, desire is propped up by a fantasy, at least one foot of which is in the other, and precisely the one that counts, even and above all, if it happens to limp. The object, as I have shown in Freudian experience, the object of desire, where we see it in its nakedness, is but the slag of a fantasy in which the subject does not come to after blacking out. It is a case of necrophilia. The object generally vacillates in a manner that is complementary to the subject's vacillation. This is what makes it as ungraspable as it is the object of the law, according to Kant. But here we suspect that a rapprochement is necessary. Doesn't the moral law represent desire in the case in which it is no longer the subject, or rather the object that is missing? Doesn't the subject alone, remaining present in the form of the voice within, speaking nonsensically most of the time, seem to be adequately signified by the bar with which the signifier S-barred bastardizes him, that signifier being released from the fantasy, barred S, lozenge, little a, from which it derive in the two senses of the term. Derive, meaning both derives and drifts. Although this symbol returns the commandment from within at which Kant marvels to its rightful place, it opens our eyes to the encounter which from law to desire goes further than the slipping away of their object for both the law and desire. It is the encounter in which the ambiguity of the word freedom plays a part. The moralist, by grabbing freedom for himself, always strikes me as more impudent still than imprudent. But let us listen to Kant himself illustrate it once more. Quote, suppose someone alleges that his lustful inclination is quite irresistible to him when he encounters the favoured object and the opportunity. Ask him whether, if in front of the house where he finds this opportunity, a gallows were erected on which he would be strung up immediately after gratifying his lust, he would not then conquer his inclination. One does not have to guess long that he would reply, but ask him whether, if his prince demanded, on the threat of the same prompt penalty of death, that he give false testimony against an honest man whom the prince would like to ruin under specious pretenses, he might consider it possible to overcome his love of life, however great it may be. He will, perhaps, not venture to assure us whether or not he would overcome that love, but he must concede without hesitation that doing so would be possible for him. He judges, therefore, that he can do something because he is conscious that he ought to do it, and he cognizes freedom within himself, the freedom with which, otherwise, without the moral law, he would have remained unacquainted. The first response that is presumed to be given here by a subject about whom we are first told that a great deal transpires by means of words gives me the impression that we are not being given the letter of what he said, when that is the crux of the matter. But for the fact is that in order to express it, Kant prefers to rely on someone whose sense of shame we would in any case risk offending, for in no case would he stoop so low, namely the ideal bourgeois to whom Kant elsewhere declares that he takes his hat off, no doubt in order to counter Fontel, the overly gallant centenarian. We will excuse the hoodlum, then, from having to testify under oath, but it is possible that a partisan of passion, who would be blind enough to combine it with questions of honour, would make trouble for Kant by forcing him to recognize that no occasion precipitates certain people more surely toward their goal than one that involves defiance of or even contempt for the gallows. For the gallows is not the law, nor can the gallows be wheeled in by the law here. Only the police have the necessary trucks, and while the police can be the state, as Hegel says, the law is something else, as we have known since Antigone. Kant, besides, does not contradict this with his apologue. The gallows is brought in merely so that he can attach to it, along with the subject, his love of life. Now this is what the desire and the maxim, et non propter vitem vivendi perdere causas, can become in a moral being rising precisely because he is moral, to the rank of a categorical imperative, assuming he has his back to the wall, which is precisely where he is forced here. Desire, what is called desire, suffices to make life meaningless if it turns someone into a coward. And when law is truly present, desire does not stand up, but that is because law and repressed desire are one and the same thing, which is precisely what Freud discovered. We are ahead at half time, Professor. Let us chalk up our success to the infantry, the key to the game, as we know, for we have not brought in either our knight, which would have been easy, since it would be Sard, whom we believe to be qualified enough here, our bishop, our rook, human rights, freedom of thought, your body is your property, or our queen, an appropriate figure with which to designate the daring deeds of courtly love. This would have involved moving too many people for a less certain result. For if I claim that for a few bantering remarks, Sard risked, knowing full well what he was doing, considering what he did with his outings, whether illicit or illicit, imprisonment in the Bastille for a third of his lifetime, it was rather well-aimed banter, no doubt, but all the more demonstrative with respect to its recompense. I'll have Pinel and his Pinelopes take aim at me. Moral madness, the latter opine, in any case a fine affair it is. I am reminded to show respect for Pinel, to whom we owe one of the noblest steps of humanity. 13 years in Charenton for Sard were, however, part of this step, I retort. But he should not have been sent there, I am told. That's the whole point, I continue. It was Pinel's step that led him there. His place, and all thinkers agree on this point, was elsewhere. But there you have it. Those who think clearly think that his place was outside, and the right thinking, starting with Royer Collard, who demanded it at the time, wanted him condemned to hard labour, if not the scaffold. This is precisely why Pinel was an important moment in the history of thought. Willy-nilly, he supported the destruction on the right and the left by thought of freedoms that the revolution had just promulgated in the very name of thought. But if we consider human rights from the vantage point of philosophy, we see what, in any case, everyone knows about their truth. They boil down to the freedom of to desire in vain. A lot of good that does. But it gives us an opportunity to recognize in it the impulsive freedom we saw earlier, and to confirm that it is clearly the freedom to die. But it also gives us the opportunity to be frowned upon by those who find it low in nutritional value. They are plentiful in our time. We see here the renewed conflict between needs and desires, in which, as if by chance, it is the law that empties the shell. To counter Kant's apologue, courtly love offers us a no less tempting path, but it requires us to be erudite. To be erudite by one's position is to bring on the attack of the erudites in this field that is tantamount to the entrance of the clowns. Kant could very easily make us lose our serious demeanor here already, since he hasn't the slightest sense of comedy. This is proved by what he says about it when he discusses it. But someone who has no sense of comedy whatsoever is Sade, as has been pointed out. This topic could perhaps be fatal to him, but a preface is not designed to do the author a disservice. Let us thus turn to the second stage of Kant's apologue. It no more proves his point that the first stage did. For assuming that Kant's helot here has the slightest presence of mind, he will ask Kant if perchance it would be his duty to bear true witness were this the means by which the tyrant could satisfy his desire. Should he say that the innocent man is a Jew, for example, if he truly is one, before a tribunal? We have seen such situations that considers this a punishable offence. Or that he is an atheist, when it is quite possible that he himself has a better grasp on the import of the accusation than a consistory that simply wants to establish a file. And in the case of some deviation from the party line, will he plead that this deviation is not guilty at a time and a place where the name of the game is autocritique? Why wouldn't he? After all, is an innocent man ever completely spotless? Will he say what he knows? We would make the maxim that one must counter a tyrant's desire into a duty if a tyrant is someone who appropriates the power to enslave the other's desire. Thus, with regard to the two examples and the precarious mediation between them, that Kant uses a lever to show that the law weighs in the scales not only pleasure but also pain, happiness, and even the burden of abject poverty, not to mention the love of life. In short, everything pathological, it turns out that desire can have not only the same success but can obtain it more legitimately. But if the credence we lent to the critique due to the alacrity of its argumentation owed something to our desire to know where it was heading, can't the ambiguity of this success turn the movement back toward a revising of the six concessions we unwittingly made? For example, the disgrace that rather quickly befell all objects that were proposed as goods because they were incapable of achieving a harmony of wills, simply because they introduced competition. Such was the case of Milan, about which both Charles V and François I knew what it cost them for each to see the same good in it. For that is clearly to misrecognize the status of the object of desire. I can introduce its status here only by reminding you what I teach about desire, which must be formulated as the other's desire, since it is originally desire for what the other desires. This is what makes the harmony of desires conceivable but not devoid of danger. For when desires line up in a chain that resembles the procession of Bruegel's blind men, each one, no doubt, has his hand in the hand of the one in front of him, but no one knows where they are all going. Now, in retracing their steps, they all clearly experience a universal rule, but this is because they do not know any more about it. Would the solution in keeping with practical reason be that they go around in circles? Even when lacking, the gaze is clearly the object that presents each desire with its universal rule. By materializing its cause, in binding to it the subject's division between center and absence. Let us therefore confine ourselves to saying that a practice like psychoanalysis, which takes desire as the subject's truth, cannot misrecognize what follows without demonstrating what it represses. In psychoanalysis, displeasure is understood to provide a pretext for repressing desire. Displeasure arising as it does along the pathway of desire's satisfaction, but displeasure is also understood to provide the form this very satisfaction takes in the return of the repressed. Similarly, pleasure redoubles its aversion when it recognizes the law by supporting the desire to comply with it that constitutes defense. If happiness means that the subject finds uninterrupted pleasure in his life, as the Critique of Practical Reason defines it quite classically, it is clear that happiness is denied to whomever does not renounce the pathway of desire. This renunciation can be willed, but at the cost of man's truth, which is quite clear from the disapproval of those who upheld the common ideal that the Epicureans and even the Stoics met with. Their ataraxia deposed their wisdom. We fail to realize that they degraded desire. And not only do we not consider the law to be commensurably exalted by them, but it is precisely because of this degrading of desire that, whether we know it or not, we sense that they cast down the law. Sade, the former aristocrat, takes up Saint Just right where one should. The proposition that happiness has become a political factor is incorrect. It has always been a political factor and will bring back the scepter and the censor that make do with it very well. Rather, it is the freedom to desire that is a new factor, not because it has inspired a revolution. People have always fought and died for a desire, but because this revolution wants its struggle to be for the freedom of desire. Consequently, the revolution also wants the law to be free, so free that it must be a widow, the widow par excellence, the one that sends your head to the basket if it so much as balks regarding the matter at hand. Had St. Just's head remained full of the fantasies in Organt, Thermidor might have been a triumph for him. Were the right to jouissance recognized, it would consign the domination of the pleasure principle to an obsolete era. In enunciating this right, Sade imperceptibly displaces for each of us the ancient axes of ethics, which is but the egoism of happiness. One cannot say that every reference to it is eliminated in Kant's work, given the very familiarity with which it accompanies him, and still more, given the offshoots of it seen in the exigencies that make him argue both for some retribution in the hereafter and progress in this world. Should another happiness be glimpsed, whose name I first uttered, the status of desire would change, demanding a re-examination of it. But it is here that something must be gauged. How far does Sade lead us in the experience of this jouissance, by simply of its truth? For the human pyramids he described, which are fabulous insofar as they demonstrate the cascading nature of jouissance, these water buffets of desire built so that jouissance makes the villa, dest, gardens, sparkle with a baroque voluptuousness. The higher they try to make jouissance spurt up into the heavens, the more insistently the question, what is it that is flowing here, demands to be answered. Unpredictable quanta, by which the love and hate atom glistens in the vicinity of the thing from which man emerges through a cry, what is experienced beyond certain limits, has nothing to do with what desire is propped up by in fantasy, which is, in fact, constituted on the basis of these limits. We know that Sade went beyond these limits in real life, otherwise he probably would not have given us this blueprint of his fantasy in his work. Perhaps I will surprise people when I call into question what his work also tries to convey of this real experience. Confining our attention to the bedroom for a rather lively glimpse of the girl's feelings about her mother, the fact remains that wickedness, so suitably situated by Sade and its transcendence, does not teach us much that is new here about her changes of heart. A work that wishes to be bad cannot allow itself to be a bad piece of work, and one has to admit that philosophy in the bedroom leaves itself open to this ironic remark by a whole strain of good works found in it. It's a little too preachy. Of course, it is a treatise on the education of girls, and it is subject as such to the laws of a genre, despite its merit of bringing to the light the anal sadism that obsessively permeated this subject for the two preceding centuries. It remains a treatise on education. The victim is bored by death, to death by the preaching, and the teacher is full of himself. The historical, or better, erudite information here is dreary and makes us miss someone like La Mothe Levaille. The physiology contained in it is made up of wet nurses' notions, and as for what might pass for sex education, one has the impression that one is reading a modern medical treatise on the subject, which says it all. More coherence in his scandal would help him see, in the usual impotence of educational intentions, the very impotence against which fantasy here fights, whence arises the obstacle to every valid account of the effects of education, since what brought about the results cannot be admitted to it in discussing the intention. This remark would have been priceless due to the praiseworthy effects of sadistic impotence. The fact that Sade failed to make it gives us pause for thought. His failure here is confirmed by another that is no less remarkable. The work never presents us with a successful seduction in which his fantasy would nevertheless find its crowning glory. That is, a seduction in which the victim, even if she were at her last gasp, would consent to her tormentor's intention, or even join his side in the fervour of her consent. This demonstrates from another vantage point that desire is the flip side of the law. In the Sadean fantasy, we see how they support each other. For Sade, one is always on the same side. The good or the bad, no wrongdoing can change that. It is thus the triumph of virtue. This paradox merely comes down to the derision characteristic of edifying books, the kind of Justine aims at too much not to have adopted it. Apart from the nose that twitches, which we find at the end of the dialogue of a priest with a dying man, a posthumous work, admit that this is a subject hardly suited to other graces than divine grace, a lack of witticism, and one might say, more broadly, of the wit, the need for which Alexander Pope had, over a century before, already indicated, makes itself felt at times in Sade's work. This is obviously forgotten owing to the invasion of pedantry that has weighed on French letters since World War II. But if you need a strong stomach to follow Sade when he recommends calumny, the first article of morality that would institute in his republic, one might prefer that he add the spice of someone like Renan. Let us be thankful, the latter writes, that Jesus encountered no law against insulting a whole class of citizens, for the Pharisees would have been inviolable. Renan continues, his exquisite mockery and magic provocations always hit home. The Nisus tunic of ridicule that the Jew and the son of Pharisees has been dragging in tatters behind him for 18 centuries was woven by Jesus with divine skill, a masterpiece of high-level mockery. His scathing remarks have become burned into the flesh of the hypocrite and of the falsely devout, incomparable remarks worthy of a son of God. Only a god knows how to kill in this fashion. Socrates and Moliere merely graze the skin. Jesus carries fire and rage into the very depths of his bones, of one's bones. For these remarks derive their value from the sequel that we know. I mean his vocation as an apostle from the rank of the Pharisees and the universal triumph of Pharisaic virtues. This, you will agree, lends itself to an argument that is more relevant than the rather sorry excuse that Sartre is content with in his apology for calumny, namely that an honest man will always triumph over it. This platitude does not encumber the somber beauty that radiates from the monument of challenges. This beauty evinces the experience that I am seeking behind the make-believe quality of the fantasy. It is a tragic experience insofar as it projects its condition here in a light that comes from beyond all fear and pity. Bewilderment and shadows, such is the conjunction, unlike that found in jokes, that fascinates us in these scenes with its ember-like brilliance. This tragedy is of the kind that becomes clearer later on in the century in more than one work, whether erotic novel or religious drama. I would call it senile tragedy. Until I said so, no one realized, except schoolboys in their jokes, that it is but a stone's throw from noble tragedy. To see what I mean, read Claudel's trilogy, Le Perrier Humili. To see what I mean, one should also know that I've shown that this trilogy contains the characteristics of the most authentic tragedy. It is the Melpomene who, along with Cleo, is decrepit, without our knowing which one will bury the other. We are now finally enjoined to examine Sartre, my neighbour, the invocation of which we owe to the perspicacity of Pierre Klosowski. Being extreme, his perspicacity has no need to resort to the same things as the highbrow literati. It is undoubtedly Klosowski's discretion that makes him justify his formulation with a reference to Saint Labre. I do not, however, feel inclined to give it the same justification. My structural reference points make it easy to grasp that the Sartrean fantasy is better situated among the stays of Christian ethics than elsewhere. But what must be kept in mind is that Sartre himself refuses to be my neighbour, not so that I can refuse to be his neighbour in turn, but so as to recognise the meaning of his refusal here. In my view, Sartre does not have neighbourly enough relations with his own malice to encounter his neighbour in it, a characteristic he shares with many people, and with Freud in particular, for this is indeed the only reason why beings who are sometimes experienced back away from the Christian commandment. We see what is, to my mind, the crucial test of this in Sartre's rejection of the death penalty, the history of which would suffice to prove, if not its logic, at least that it is one of the correlates of charity. Sartre thus stopped at the point where desire and the law become bound up with each other. If someone in him let itself remain tied to the law in order to take the opportunity mentioned by St. Paul to become inordinately sinful, who would cast the first stone? But Sartre went no further. It is not simply that his flesh is weak, as it is for each of us. It is that the spirit is too willing not to be deluded. His apology for crime merely impels him to an oblique acceptance of the law. The supreme being is restored in evil action. Listen to him praise his technique of immediately implementing whatever comes into his head, thinking too that by replacing repentance with reiteration, he can be done with the law within. To encourage us to follow his example, he comes up with nothing better than the promise that nature, woman that she is, will magically give us evermore. We would be foolish to have faith in this typical dream of potency. It indicates to us clearly enough, in any case, that it cannot be true that Sartre, as Klosowski suggests, all the while noting that he does not believe it, achieve the sort of apathy that involves having returned to nature's bosom in the waking state in our world inhabited by language. I have forbidden myself to say a word about what Sartre is missing here. Let it be sensed in the climax of Philosophy in the Bedroom, it being the curved needle dear to Buñuel's heroes, which is finally called upon to resolve in the girl a penis knife, penis envy that is posited to some degree in it. In any case, it appears that nothing has been gained by replacing Diotima here with Dolmans, a person whom the usual orifice seems to frighten more than is fitting, and who, did Sard see this, concludes the whole business with a sort of noli tangere matrem. Syphilized and sewn shut, the mother remains prohibited. My verdict is confirmed regarding Sard's submission to the law. There is thus precious little here, in fact, nothing by way of a treatise that is truly on desire. What is announced about desire here, in this mistake based on an encounter, is at most but a tone of reason. September 1962.